One of my favorite movies of all time is The Count of Monte Cristo. Has anybody ever seen that before? Anybody seen that? Yeah, it was like two people in the first service. You got to go see it. Anyway, The Count of Monte Cristo is a great adventure story. It actually started out as a novel, and it's been made into a movie twice because it's such a great story. Now, part of the reason I like it is because in my family, now that I'm married, right, we've been married for 7 years, me and Mandy, we watch a lot of, you know, romantic comedies and stuff. So, like, you know, I don't get to watch Rambo anymore, you know? So I like the adventure stuff. And so, anyway, I like this movie a lot. And one of the things that I like about it, there's so many twists and turns. There's so many, like, things that happen. And it's almost unbelievable how the pieces that this thing connected to this thing, and if this wouldn't happen, then this wouldn't happen, and it's just, it blows your mind by the time you get to the end. I love movies like that. In fact, it reminds me of, this guy's got a weird name, but movies by M. Night Shyamalan. I'm sorry to say that three times fast, right? But anyway, he's the guy that did The Sixth Sense. Anybody ever seen The Sixth Sense? Many of us have seen that, right? I see dead people. You know, it's what kept us up at night and making us look under our bed, you know, stuff like that. But anyway, their movie is very similar, except The Count of Monte Cristo is not creepy and not scary. Because what happens in movies like that, movies like both of those, is you're going along and then something happens near the end that changes the entire picture. I mean, something changes and you're like, wow, I never saw that happening. I never saw it coming. This changes everything I saw before. And so it makes you want to go back and rewatch it because you start to realize that the story that you thought you were watching was actually part of a much bigger story, maybe even a different story than what you thought you were watching before. And so with that, that's where we're starting out Ruth today. We're finishing up our series, Redeeming Ruth, and we've been in the book of Ruth. We've been talking about that great story of hope in the Old Testament, and it's a real life story that's very similar to movies like that. In fact, we've been going along, we've been watching this movie scene in the book of Ruth, and it's setting up like this amazing romantic, not comedy, but romance, and all of a sudden, there's going to be something that's going to happen today that's going to expand the story way bigger than what we saw on the surface. And so I'm really excited about today. So chapter 4 is where we're going to be. It's right after the book of Judges in the Old Testament. The words are also going to be on the screen. But before we jump in, let me tell you this. Here's where we're going today. And the bottom line for today, the bottom line is this, is that your story or the story you're living, your story is part of a bigger story that God is writing. Your story is part of a bigger story that God is writing or that God is orchestrating. In fact, we all have a tendency in our lives to zoom in on only our circumstances, to zoom in on what's happening right now in this moment in time. And we zoom in sometimes on a problem that's going on in our life. And sometimes that becomes like the only reality we see. Or we zoom in on only the life that we're living. And oftentimes we don't realize how God might be putting together the pieces for your good, for His glory, or to advance His kingdom in the world in a way that you didn't even see coming. God is doing more in your story. And your story is part of a bigger story that God is writing or that God is orchestrating in your life. And so before we jump into chapter 4, let me tell you where we've been. I'm one of those, I forget stuff about what we've been talking about. If you're just joining us, you'll get caught up really quick. But for those of us like me, we'll be a good refresher. Here's what's happened so far in the book of Ruth. It is the time period of the judges. And the time period of the judges was the time where the people of God were finally living in the promised land. They were in the land they always prayed that they would be in. They were in the land that they always wanted to be in, and God brought them there. And isn't it funny how once they get to the promised land, something that happens in our lives oftentimes, they get what they always wanted from God, and then they start turning away from God and doing life on their own. You know, we do this so many times. You know, it's almost like we treat God like a genie. You know, God, rub the lamp, deliver things in my life, and then I'll move on to my life. And this is what they do. And the book of Judges, right before this, it tells us that it was a time where not only were people turning away from God, but everybody was doing what was right in their own eyes. So just imagine, there's like kind of no moral compass. There's no king in Israel. Everybody just kind of doing what they want. And it was chaos. It was dark. And it was bleak. And so the book of Ruth enters, and it says not only that, but it enters with this this worst picture where a famine breaks out in Bethlehem. Bethlehem means house of bread. So in the house of bread, there's no bread. There's no food. And so the story zooms in on this family, this one family, Elimelech, his wife Naomi, and their two sons. And this really bad decision that they made to, when things got difficult in their life, instead of remaining in the promised land where God had called them to be, they decided, because things were difficult, to walk away and to leave that place where God wanted them to be. And they go to this place called Moab, which is outside of the promised land and outside of where God called them to be. Never a good decision. And it's interesting because so many times we do this in our lives where, you know, we know God is calling us here or in certain direction in our life, but oftentimes we'll step just outside of where God wants us, just outside of his will for our life, so that we're close enough that we can taste or we can see that, but we don't really step both feet in. And this is what they do. They step just outside. And when they're in this land called Moab, outside of the promised land, personal tragedy strikes. Suddenly, out of nowhere, Elimelech passes away. And they're trying to figure out, man, what do we go from here? And a few years later, Naomi's two sons pass away. And so Naomi, this poor woman, is left with just her Moabite daughters-in-law, Ruth and Orpah, women who weren't even followers of God at that point. And so they are trying to figure out how to do life and how do we figure this out. And so Ruth basically says, daughters, go home. Like, go back to your mom so you can be provided for. And Orpah decides to say, all right, I'll follow those instructions. She goes back home to her mom, to her dad, and to their gods. But Ruth clings to her mother-in-law, and she says this famous line in Ruth 1, verse 16. She says, wherever you go, I'll go. Wherever you stay, I'll stay. Your people, the people of God, will be my people, and your God, my God. This huge statement of faith where Ruth is clinging to her mother-in-law, almost like this marriage covenant. It's like, no matter where you go, I'm going to be with you. And she commits her life to the Lord, and she says, I'm going to stay with you no matter what. And so Naomi heads back to Bethlehem because there's news that the famine is over. There's food and blessing now in the house of bread in Bethlehem. Isn't it interesting that God provided for the people who stayed, who remained faithful to where he called them to be? But they return home, and this time she's with Ruth. But Naomi, when she returns, she went away full, and she's returning home empty. And so she's very, very bitter. She's got this honest hurt because a lot of stuff has happened where she feels like she's lost everything. So the next day, Ruth chapter 2, Ruth goes to gather some food in a field that just so happens, the scripture says, just so happens, God, to be the field of a man named Boaz, the family member of Naomi's husband who passed away. Aha. And Boaz is a man's man. We talked about this a couple weeks ago. He is a non-sweater vest wearing dude. You know, he is a non-peppermint frappuccino, you know, drinking guy. You know, he is a man's man. Almost picture like Rambo or Chuck Norris and Gaston, you know, all these kind of dudes. Like, he's a man's man. And you know, if you ever have a dog, it's a good name, Boaz. You know, especially a boy dog, right? But anyway, Boaz is so gracious. He's so gracious. He goes above what the law required and showers her with blessings. He gives Ruth, he protects her, he provides for her. He sends her back with way more grain than they could eat in a few days. Tons of grain. But the problem is Ruth and Naomi are still left with kind of a curse upon the one of the ultimate curses. They're widowed during that time. And not only that, they're childless women. And during that time, it's different today, but during that time, it meant that they had a need for food, it meant they had a need for provision, and they had a need for family. And if you didn't have a male heir that could carry on your family line, it was seen as one of the greatest tragedies, one of the greatest disappointments, one of the greatest curses. And so in chapter 2, Boaz starts to answer their need for food and provision. So that's great, but what about family? He's not, you know, doing anything to pursue Ruth. And so Naomi, the mother-in-law, gets involved, right? She starts playing matchmaker, you know, on farmersonly.com, you know? And, you know, because they're in the field. But anyway, she comes up with this shady plan, you know? And she, like, you know, tries to link them together. And she basically tells Ruth, hey, throw yourself at Boaz. And so Boaz and Ruth have this really shady night at the threshing floor. And you can go back and listen online to last week if you want to hear what that's about. But anyway, Ruth basically proposes. Ruth, the woman in this culture, proposes to Boaz and says, please marry me. Please redeem me. Take me in as your own. And he's flattered. He sees her kindness and her character, and they're staring up at the stars together, you know, and everything seems right in the world. There's, you know, love songs everywhere, you know. You hear this. And then all of a sudden, he tells her this interesting thing. He tells her this thing. He basically says, honey, I've got some news. There's someone else. There's someone else who has the right to marry you before I can. By the law, he has the first shot at marrying you. So, big letdown, you know. It's like, that's not what it's supposed to be. And so that's where we begin today. Will she be redeemed? And if she is it going to be Boaz, this guy that loves her so much, as we've seen, or is it going to be this other guy? We don't even know who he is. So here's how it goes. Ruth chapter 4, starting with verse 1. It says, meanwhile, Boaz went up to the town gate and sat down there just as the guardian redeemer he had mentioned came along. Boaz said, come over here, my friend. Now, let's stop here. When he says, come over here, my friend, that's in the Hebrew. It's not just, hey, friend. It's a literal omission of his name. He doesn't say his name. In fact, the literal Hebrew here is basically, hey, Mr. So-and-so. It's a family member of his. He knows who it is. But the scripture, for this author of the scripture, and you're going to see why, purposely omits him because he's not worth even mentioning. He says, come over here, Mr. So-and-so, and sit down. And so he went over and sat down. Verse 2, Boaz took 10 of the elders of the town and said, sit here. And they did so. See, he's a man's man. When he says sit, you sit, right? Verse 3, then he said to the guardian redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling the piece of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. I thought I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you buy it in the presence of these seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, do so. But if you will not, tell me so I will know. For no one has the right to do it except you, and I am the next in line. Oh, how romantic, right? It's like, what in the world? Like, I thought you kind of like, you know, I thought you were having feelings for this girl. He said, first of all, one of the things I like about Boaz is he's to the point. You know, as a man's man, we're going to settle matters today. Sit down, we're settling this. What's going to happen with Ruth? I love that. You know, instead of delaying, he's going to resolve it. But notice this, Boaz presents this whole redemption thing as a land acquisition. How romantic, right? It's like, is she just property? Is that all I am to you? You know, we had marriage night. This is a good fight moment. So, but anyway, not with y'all, but for them. So Boaz, he sets us up like a land acquisition. And let me just put it in our context, because it's kind of funny. It's almost like he's saying, so Mr. So-and-so, I've got this great piece of land. I've got this great piece of land. It's got a good price. Here's kind of what it looks like. It's on the lake, Lake Lanier. Of course, this is our context, not theirs. But just, oh, it's a beautiful house. It's got a lot of bedrooms. It's got an American flag. It's Merkin. You know, it's real patriotic. Yeah, that's right. And there's probably pool tables and, you know, there might be a basketball court there. And it's right on the water. There's a boat slip, in fact, for two boats. And guess what? It's at a great price. Here's the only catch. And it's not a big deal. You know, there's a bitter old woman that lives upstairs. She comes with the house. Are you in? This is kind of what happens here, you know. It's like, well, you can just imagine what he's thinking. He's looking at the property, and he's thinking, well, it is a nice property, and I have wanted to, you know, have property like that someday. It sounds like a good deal. The old lady, that's bitter, I don't know. Well, she is kind of old, and he's talking about Naomi. Just imagine him thinking this, like, well, Naomi's pretty advanced in age, and maybe she won't be around that much longer, and so maybe she'll pass on, and then I get to keep all the land. And so here's my answer, Boaz. Here's what he says, verse 4, the end of verse 4. He says, I will redeem it, he said. I'll do it. I'll redeem it. In other words, sold, you know? I'll take the land. That's a great deal. In fact, this is one of those things where as the readers, we're tracking with the story and all of us say, no, that's not the way it's supposed to be. I mean, what was that one in a million talk, Boaz, you know, that you were having at the threshing floor? This is not the romance we signed up for. Land, and you're going to sell it to him, Mr. So-and-so. But let's give Boaz a little bit more credit here. He's a smart dude. Not only is he a man's man, but he's a smart dude, and he knows his family member, and he knows what drives him. And so it's almost like he's cast out, you know, he's cast out the line, he's set the hook, and now he's going to go in with even more information. Check out what it says, verse 5. It says this. It says, "Then Boaz said, 'On the day you buy the land from Naomi, you also acquire Ruth, the Moabite.'" Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention that, right? He said, "The dead man's widow, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property." At this, the guardian redeemer said, "Then I cannot redeem it because I might endanger my own estate." He says, "You redeem it yourself. I cannot do it." And this is where we say, yes, you know? But it's interesting. Why did he back out? Like, why was that a big deal? I mean, the land, the property was good, and then now there's like a younger woman, and here's the deal. He's basically saying, "Oh, by the way, Mr. So-and-so, you're going to have to marry a Moabite." This is almost like, to put it in our context, it's like a New England Patriots person, you know? It's like, oh, they beat us in the Super Bowl. We got to marry her, you know? This is the way it is. We don't associate with these kind of people, right? And so this is one of the things. But the other thing is not only is she a Patriots fan or whatever, but she is young enough to have kids. And that means if you take her in, you marry her, you guys have kids or descendants, then all of this that you just bought goes back to them. So here's the deal. You can buy it today, pay today, you can raise her kids and your kids, and then later when they get older, you can give it all back to them for free. Are you in? He's like, no way. Like, I got my own family to take care of. I got my own descendants to distribute, you know, my inheritance to someday. In other words, I was all for redemption until I realized it was going to cost me something. That'll preach. I was all for redemption until I realized it was going to cost me something. He's not a real redeemer. Because here's the thing, we're going to see with Boaz that a true redeemer is willing to pay the price no matter what it costs. And so here's how the story continues, verse 7. It says this. It says, "Now in earlier times in Israel, for the redemption and transfer of property to become final, one party took off his sandal," yuck, "and gave it to the other. This was a method of legalizing transactions in Israel," you know, so you get to know each other real well. All right, "so the guardian redeemer said to Boaz, 'Buy it yourself,' and he removed his sandal. Then Boaz announced to the elders and all the people, 'Today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth, the Moabite, Mahlon's widow, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from his hometown. Today, you are witnesses.'" And here's what the crowd says. It says, "The elders and all the people at the gate said, 'We are witnesses. May the Lord make the women who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah.'" And this is where they're tearing up as they're watching this. They said, "Who together built up the family of Israel. May you have standing in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. Through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah." And so I love this. Let's just get this picture here. I mean, we've been waiting this whole time. We kind of left off last week, and every single week we've been wondering this question, like, will the hope that's been shattered in their life be restored? Will everything that's been turned upside down in their life, is there any plan? Is there any future for them? And here we see all the pieces coming together. There's butterflies in the air and fireworks going off and confetti raining down. And, you know, this is like they're all lived happily ever after. This is their happily ever after. I mean, she's being redeemed. She's being restored. And everything that was turned upside down is beginning to be made right. And so here's the first thing we notice with this. Number one, we notice that it's a happily ever after for Ruth because she's given a new identity. She's given a new identity, Ruth. Think about her identity before, this woman, Ruth. Everything that she was before, everything she had before, basically fell apart in her life. I mean, Ruth, her identity before was that she was a foreigner. She was a stranger. She was a Moabite. She was outside, a stranger to the people of God. But now, she's got a new identity. She's no longer outside of the people of God. Now, because of what Boaz has done, now it means that she's officially part of God's people. She's a part of the nation of Israel. She's grafted into the family of God. She has a new identity. What was she before? The other thing, she was a follower and a worshiper of false gods. But now she's committed her life to the Lord. She's following the Lord. She's got a new identity. Before, her identity was she was a widow with no family and with no way of being provided for. But now she's being provided for by, now that she has a husband in this society, she has not only provision, but a way to have a future in her life. Before, she was a woman. Her identity was no hope. But now God has put the pieces together to give her a hope and a future. And so God has given her this incredible new identity where her life was saved by one single act of redemption. One single act of redemption brought her a new identity. And it means it was all because her Redeemer was willing to pay the price. Now, do you see the gospel parallel to this? I mean, it is so blatant how the story is happening because it's our story. I mean, it's not about Ruth. It's about our story because this is what God does for us. When Jesus comes into our life, he came to give us a new identity. That we all were foreigners and strangers living outside of the family of God until his grace called us. And we stepped across the line, not because of our works, but because of what Jesus has already done for us. We're able to become part of the family of God. We become people of God. In fact, it's one of those things where no longer are we poor and lowly and unworthy. Now God says, you get to become, as we sang, my sons and daughters. You're sons and daughters of the King. And this is what's happened because of grace. And the thing that's cool about this is not only do we get the relationship with God, although we were once outside, now we're inside of the family of God and with God. But now he says, you are heirs. You're kings and priests through Jesus. You're heirs of everything that I have and everything that I am. It's yours because you're my kids. You know, it's one of the things when, and this is how parenting works as well. You know, it's like my kids, if they ever need anything, you know, it's like we're not going to give them everything in the world. But man, if they need anything, they're my kids. Like I'm going to provide for them. I'm going to do whatever I can, right? And how much more will our Heavenly Father, you know, who loves us so much. If we're connected to him, he opens up his hand. And this is not prosperity gospel. I just mean he opens up the heavens and blessing. And he pours into our life and gives us a new identity. That no longer are we outside, but now we're a new creation, living a different story. And so, and that's the first thing. So she was given a new identity, and we are too in Jesus. And so what about Naomi? What's her deal? Here's how the story continues, verse 13. Verse 13, it says this. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. When he made love to her, the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The women said to Naomi, "Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughters-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth." Then Naomi took the child in her arms and cared for him. And so here's the second thing we learn. Not only is she given a new identity, but for Naomi, she was given her happily ever after. For Naomi, she was given a happily ever after of new life. New life. Everything is restored. In fact, before, think about it. Everything in her life fell apart. It was broken and shattered, and all the pieces are laying around everywhere. And how, you know, it's almost like a mirror that just crashes on the floor. And you look at it like, how are we ever going to be able to put these pieces back together that's my life? And what God has done in just a short time, God has picked up every one of those pieces and glued them and sealed them together. And all of a sudden, her story and her future looks so much different. She's given new life. And so she had lost her husband. She lost her family. She had no hope and no future. But now she was saying in chapter one, she was bitter. She was saying things like, God's against me. And the record kept playing. Everything's falling apart. Where is God? But all of a sudden, now everything has been restored. He's renewed her life. And so here's the thing. She went from being abandoned, feeling abandoned and feeling so bitter, to God has given her this new life. And in the same way, this is what Jesus does in our lives when we get connected to him. That as the pieces of our life are scattered on the floor, right? And as we're as the person God creates to be is marred by sin and decisions to turn away from God, God can pick up the pieces of your life, every single disappointment and discouragement, and every single time we've walked away from Him, He can put together the pieces of your story through His grace and can put us back together again. And so it's one of those things we are given not only new identity, but we're given new life. And this could be the end of the story, right? It's like they ride off into the sunset and it was happily ever after, right? We've seen movies like that, Cinderella, stuff like that. But I want you to check out how this story ends. It continues going. It's like, land the plane, dude. Here's, you know, it's inspired word of God. But check this out. Verse 17. Very, very, very interesting what happens here, right? All right. The women living there said, Naomi has a son. And they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now, here's the really, really interesting part. Here's what it says. This then is the family line of Perez. Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron, the father of Ram. Ram, the father of Amminadab. Amminadab, the father of Nahshon. Nahshon, the father of Salmon. Salmon, the father of Boaz. Boaz, the father of Obed. Obed, the father of Jesse. And Jesse, the father of David. Seriously? You ruined the love story, right? Like, why do you include a genealogy at the end of this? You know, they're riding off into the sunset, and we get this boring genealogy, right? It seems so kind of pointless, doesn't it? Like, what in the world is going on? Way to mess up the ending. But it's actually the perfect ending. It's the perfect ending to this perfect story, because let me illustrate it to you like this. Have you ever seen the movie, anybody ever seen the movie Ants before? It's a cartoon. Anybody ever seen that? Yeah, some of y'all have. If you have kids, you may have seen it. But anyway, it's about a colony of ants. And it's a cool story where there's this worker ant who falls in love with the princess ant. You know, there's always a princess. You know, you watch that movie with all the ups and downs and all the things that are going on and how they defeated the evil general. And after you watch this whole thing and everything that's happened in the ant colony, the movie actually ends like this. Check it out. So they're all celebrating together, right? They're lifting each other up. You know, this is the happily ever after for the ants. Things are going well. This is exactly what we wanted to happen. Can't believe this. And we see all the ants and all the ant colony. And wow, everybody's just, you know, so engaged in this. But as the story starts to zoom out further and further and further away, you start to realize that, whoa, that story we were watching the whole time is just a tiny little speck, this tiny little ant colony. And it's interesting because, you know, here's a big butterfly in the middle of this story we were so zoomed in on. And we start to realize that this tiny little ant story that we are following is in the middle of a park called Central Park in New York City. And what we thought when we were zoomed in watching this one story, and we didn't even realize that it was part of a much, much bigger story. Now, here's the thing. This is really what happens. This is really what happens in the book of Ruth. It's the ultimate happily ever after. As we zoom out, we realize that it's happily ever after for the nation of Israel, but it's also happily ever after for you and me. The story of Ruth intersects our story. Here's why. Number three, happily ever after, because a future hope has been given to Israel through David, and a realized hope has been given for us. We're going to talk about that. Hope for them, but hope for us. And here's the thing. We think it's just about Boaz and Ruth and Naomi. We're watching this. But it's interesting. You think about how the story began. You're watching this story, and it was the period of the judges. There's no king in Israel. And all of a sudden, we watch this redemption story of one family, and we think it's only about what's going on in their life. But then we pan back, and we start to realize that, oh, my goodness. Because this redemption, Boaz redeeming Ruth, was so much bigger than that. Because we realized that because Boaz redeemed Ruth, their family line was able to continue. And it paved the way for the greatest king in Israel's history, King David, who would not be around, who would not exist if it wasn't for Boaz redeeming Ruth. The story of redemption would have been cut off. But not only that, it was a future hope for them, but it's a realized hope for us, because the story is so much bigger than that for us. Because when we turn to the New Testament, if you've ever read Matthew chapter 1, there is this amazing thing that most of us just skip over. It's a genealogy. It's the genealogy of Jesus, and most of us are like, oh, that's nice. Let's read the story about Jesus, right? We read that because it seems so boring, and why is that there? And this is so insignificant. But we as we look at this thing that looks so boring on the surface, you might find a few of these names familiar. Here's what's in the genealogy of Jesus, Matthew chapter 1, verse 5. It says this, Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth, Obed, the father of Jesse, verse 6, and Jesse, the father of King David. Wait a minute, we just heard that. And then in the genealogy of Jesus, there's 14 more generations that it talks about from after David, and it points all the way to Jesus. And it's one of those things where we realize that from the family line of Boaz to Ruth and Obed and Jesse and David, from this family line comes the greatest kinsman redeemer that ever lived, the one who lived among us, the one who came for us, Jesus of Nazareth, Jesus who is called the Christ or the Messiah. See, we thought we were just watching this story of Ruth, and we thought, oh, this is cute, and this is sweet, and you know, hope it works out for her, this Ruth's redemption. But we didn't even realize this whole time that God's hand was all over human history. And if that didn't happen, then the line pointing all the way to Jesus might not have happened. Redemptive history happened because God stepped in the middle of that little situation. And so here's what I want to tell you today is in the darkest moment for a family, God is faithful. In the darkest moment of a nation of Israel, God is faithful. And in the darkest moment for the whole world, when everything was fractured and broken by sin, we see that God is faithful because he's shown his great love for us by sending a baby who was born in Bethlehem. And so you have no idea, people of God, what God intends to do with your life. That's going to shape the grand scheme of redemptive history. You never know how you decide to take a step and to follow Jesus or to love him more, how that impacts your kids and their kids and their kids and their kids. You never know how those decisions impact all of eternity. And so here's the question. If God can do all that in Ruth's story, imagine how God might be writing or orchestrating what he might be doing through your story.